Like, what do they know that the rest of us don't? Founders Fund is obviously a great defense tech investor, but they've also done a ton in financial technology. We merged those two teams essentially, and that's where the next business like came out of.
John, good to see you again. Back in the day, the first time I heard about you was through the video that you have done about Silicon Valley. That was a fantastic video. It made me actually get the book at the end and read it as well. But it gave me a fantastic landscape about the history of the VC in the community in San Francisco. It was really, really helpful to understand how to raise funds and the happenings behind the scenes and all of that. But having said that, what got you into videos? How did you start doing videos?
Yeah, I got into video during the pandemic lockdown. I'd been an entrepreneur for about a decade across two companies. And for the first time in 10 years, I had free time, basically, because there was nothing going on the weekends. There weren't any VC happy hours, no real social engagements, no friends and family stuff. So I had free time. So I'd basically just sit down on Sunday morning and think of an idea that I wanted to talk about. I would do some research, write for a few hours, then record, which took 30 minutes. And then I'd edit for another couple hours and I'd just put it up on YouTube. And it was really, really small, about 100 views a video for maybe the first year. But I did everything myself, from the writing to the recording to the editing, and I got to tinker around in motion graphics and After Effects a lot. And a lot of times I would just make videos for friends of mine who had questions. Like, one of my friends was raising money for a new startup, and I made him like a 6-video series on how to raise money. And so it was just a very fun way to kind of, you know, get in the habit of working through an idea from start to finish and really creating a thesis and trying to hone things down, and also just synthesizing everything that I'd learned and everything that I'd read. And that Silicon Valley history video was a good example of kind of where everything came together from, you know, books that I'd read along with, you know, people that I'd talked to, and was able to just really, really concisely explain the long-term history of Silicon Valley, which is something that I don't think a lot of people get when they watch, you know, the HBO show or, you know, read a TechCrunch article. Like, this goes back decades and decades and decades. Silicon Valley is really, it's like a rainforest. It's one of the metaphors that I've heard before, is that it's not just that there's a lot of VCs there or a lot of startups there. It's that there's also Stanford and Cal and this education system. And there's also military and government investment from decades ago. And all of these different things came together to kind of work in perfect harmony. And that's why, I mean, I think the latest numbers were just in Q1 of 2023, I think almost $25 billion was invested into the Bay Area. And New York was basically a distant second with like maybe $4 billion, and LA was like $2 billion. So Silicon Valley is just in a completely different category and has been for a very long time because of the history and because of just this confluence of factors. Just every different moving part came together kind of perfectly in the 50s, 60s, 70s to create. I mean, the original reason why we call it Silicon Valley is because that's where they were making silicon chips, semiconductors. Now all the semiconductors are made in Taiwan and we just do software. But, you know, a lot of the design and a lot of the promising new technology companies are still built in Silicon Valley. So it was very interesting to dive into that and give a bit of a bigger perspective. And that was something that I thought was kind of missing from YouTube in general. I really wanted to find kind of a white space. There were a lot of people that were talking about the trendy news of the day, and the stuff that gets the most clicks is always the most negative. So FTX, bankruptcy, SVB, you know, Theranos, WeWork, all these negative stories were what people were focused on if they were talking about Silicon Valley at all. I wanted to go back and talk about not only just the successes and but also some of the deeper history that was kind of missing. And then I wanted to highlight some of my friends who were doing cool startups and just building interesting things. So a lot of the videos that I've done that have done really well have been, I'm kind of the only person on YouTube that's made a video about this particular topic. It's not being covered by anyone else. And that was really key. Early on, I learned that it was very, very hard to compete on you know, making videos about Tesla, because there's a ton of Tesla bulls that make videos all the time about the stock price and all this stuff. And it, of course, it's often poorly informed, but it doesn't matter because there's already so much content there. But when you look at, you know, a company like Flexport or Varda or Cover or Bolt, Marcus Villig's company that's ride sharing in Europe, all those videos have gotten a ton of views because no one else is really talking about them on YouTube. They're only talking about the big national news stories.
How do you find these topics then?
A lot of it's just my network and friends. A lot of it is just, you know, people that I'm close with, founders that I know either from Y Combinator or through Twitter. There's a lot of times just being on the inside of the tech industry, you'll know the stories that are interesting. And there were a lot of times when I remember distinctly when Varda launched, Delian had a big following on Twitter. There were a lot of threads. It was a very bold idea to manufacture things in space. It's a really crazy company, raised a bunch of money for it. They're going to build these factories in space. It's audacious. And instantly it became a whole cycle on Twitter. And there were a lot of threads explaining how it works. And people were actually exhausted on Twitter of hearing about Varda because everyone had talked about it so much. I remember one of my friends was like, we don't need any more threads about Varda. We all know about it at this point. But on Twitter, no one had heard, or on YouTube, no one had heard about it. No one knew what this company was. So bringing that topic to a different audience was valuable. And everyone who watched the video on YouTube was like, oh, I've never heard of this company. I had no idea this was happening. And that's kind of the continuous story on YouTube, is that it's just a very different audience, much more broad, much less, tech insiders. They read a lot of newsletters. They definitely on Twitter, and they also listen to podcasts, you know, like the All In podcast, Logan Bartlett show, Andreessen Horowitz stuff. But there were very few people that were doing YouTube. Gary Tan was basically the only one. And his stuff is great. And now he's merged with YC and they're doing cool stuff. He was very much doing vlogs and these very chill, like he explains, like, you know, the fundamentals of entrepreneurship. It was great, great content. So I wanted to stand out from that and not look like a copycat, also because he just has like much, much crazier stories than I do to share. And so like kind of the historical video essay, the full story of these important companies was something that he wasn't doing. He was doing a lot of interviews and a lot of stories from a lot of personal stories and a lot of wisdom about how to build companies. And I was focused on just a very, very different type of storytelling so that it didn't look like we were kind of stepping on each other's toes. And then we were actually able to collaborate and do a crossover episode, which was really fun. It's been really cool to just see it grow.
Does this, I saw so many people sharing your videos over time, especially in Twitter. You mentioned Gary Tan, it's like I saw him sharing a lot of videos as well. But does this, do you do any specific that to get all that viewership? Or at this point in time, basically it became established, people know you. Did you use any growth hacks at the beginning or anything like this? Or was it that it was fantastic content that people really needed to see? And there was information asymmetry from Twitter and that moved to YouTube?
No, Twitter was useless. People are upset about Twitter, blocking Substack links and whatnot. But Twitter has never been a driver of YouTube views for a few reasons. I mean, going back years, way before the Elon stuff, Twitter had always nuked links, that deprioritized links in the algorithm that would take you off the platform. And that makes sense. That's the same thing with LinkedIn and Instagram, all of these platforms. They don't want you to leave the app, because once you leave and you go to a different app, then you're not using their app, you're not seeing their ads. So that was always the case. But even if they didn't, no one wants to click on a tweet that they're there kind of scrolling casually while they're waiting in line at a restaurant to get a sandwich or something, and then watch a 20-minute, YouTube video about some topic that's super deep and has music and voiceover and graphics. Like, you need to be much more engaged. It's a completely different frame of mind watching a YouTube video versus engaging with a tweet. Substack makes sense because you're already reading on Twitter. You click a link, you open it up. Maybe you read a bit of an article or the whole Substack article. So that flow kind of worked. But YouTube never drove drove or Twitter never drove YouTube views. And I only had about 1,000 followers on Twitter when I started YouTube. And I quickly eclipsed that on YouTube. All the growth came from going viral in the YouTube algorithm specifically. And that was a combination of high retention, people watching the videos all the way through, and high click-through rates. So figuring out how to package the videos in a very broad way. And this took a very, very long time. So I'll use the Varda example. So Varda was a really cool company and cool story to talk about, but no one knew what Varda was. So if you say, you know, breakdown of Varda, no one's going to click that because they don't know what Varda is. Now, Delian had a little bit of a bigger audience on Twitter, but he didn't have a big audience on YouTube. So there were actually a couple of people that did interview with Delian about Varda, and that didn't really get a lot of viral clicks because he's not like a household name yet, although he probably will be soon. But framing it in the broadest sense, like, you know, this is the future of space manufacturing, something like that is something that anyone can grab onto. And so figuring out how to frame these stories in really, really broad contexts. Like for Bolt, I was talking about Marcus Villig, the guy who built kind of the ride sharing company in Europe. The title is just Europe's Youngest Billionaire. Because everyone knows Europe, everyone knows young, everyone knows billionaire. It's an interesting hook. We don't even talk about the company's name really in the title because not as many people know about it. The logo is in the thumbnail, but it's very broad and accessible. So anyone can click on that. And then once they're in the video, they can say, okay, I actually want to know this person's story. I want to know how they did it. Mm-hmm. So just figuring that out and figuring out how to appeal to a broad audience on YouTube was what led to the growth. And you can tell very quickly when something starts going viral. Like you'll have, if you have, you know, 1,000 subscribers, which I think I did for like the first year, you'll get about 10% of those people to show up to kind of any video you put out. So you might get 100 views. But then all of a sudden, if something clicks, I remember the first time I had a video about SpaceX go viral and it got 60,000 views. And it was just insane. Like the curve just goes directly up into the right and just grows exponentially. And so when you hit something in the algorithm, it's very, very clear. And then you just have to figure out how to continue with those formats that work. And that's why you see the big YouTubers, they always use kind of the same formats. You know, Mr. Beast will say, like, you know, I gave, you know, $1 million to, you know, someone. I challenged this person to do this. And every YouTuber kind of goes in these cycles where they find specific titles and thumbnails combinations that work, and then they double down on what works and they do a lot of content around there. It can get a little stale after a while if you're doing 20 videos about the same thing. But once you find kind of a pattern that works, cashing in on that is really, really valuable.
So one is the title to get people to actually click on it, but then how do you get them to stay? Is it, I've seen you make the videos much shorter, you have a lot of, you remove all the pauses and all that, but do you have something specific there to keep the engagement?
Yeah, there's a couple things. There's a bunch of interesting strategies. I think the biggest thing is in the title, you need to tell the entire story in the title. So the best example that I have is I was talking about, I wanted to make a video about Microsoft acquiring Activision and how that had an impact on Facebook's attempt to build the metaverse. Because even though Zuck had been talking about the metaverse the most, Microsoft had a ton of gaming assets and could potentially, they own Minecraft, so they potentially own a lot of the intellectual property and potentially some of the games that could undergird the development of the metaverse. And of course, they had augmented reality glasses as well and a couple other projects they were working on. So the way to kind of inject drama in a story was I used the title Microsoft Just Killed Zuck's Metaverse. And so that's very, like, very dramatic. There's a clear protagonist and antagonist. People feel very strongly about Microsoft. Some people hate Microsoft and they love PlayStation. Some people love Facebook or hate Facebook. So layering in that drama and telling you the entire story and the entire core conflict in just 5 words was really, really key. And using really, really broad terms. Like I didn't use, you know, Satya Nadella because he's not as much of a household name as Microsoft. But, and I actually use Bill Gates in the thumbnail, even though he's not actively running the company, but he's more recognizable as a face. And then in terms of Facebook, it was confusing because there was Facebook and Meta at the time. So just saying Zuck is more broad because everyone knows who he is, even though there was some confusion over, oh, if you use the word Meta, are you talking about the metaverse broadly? Or are you talking about that specific company? And then if you talk about Facebook, are you talking about the website Facebook or the app or like the whole company? So that was a little bit more confusing. So finding a term that anyone could understand is really, really key there. And then once you're in the video, it's really important to keep people watching. And so you try and do things like tease what will happen. So with that video, you know, I kind of tell it in three parts and I tell you up front, like there are three key strategies that Microsoft's employing to build their version of the metaverse. And we're going to go through them one at a time, but I don't tell you what they are. So you need to kind of stay to the end to hear the full story.
Mm-hmm. If we go back to Silicon Valley that you mentioned earlier, was your first, the first company you started that you went through Y Combinator?
Yeah, the first company that I started went through Imagine K-12, which later became part of Y Combinator.
You had Jeff
actually had
Tim?
Yeah, Jeff Ralston and Tim Brady. Nice. And so it had some overlap with the YC partners and it was structured the exact same as YC, but PG came and did a talk, Paul Graham, and it was very similar, but you know, technically separate. But we were living, my team was living with a YC team out of an Airbnb essentially. And so once demo day happened and both companies kind of didn't raise money and the products weren't really working, we merged those two teams essentially. And that's where the next business like came out of.
Mm. And what was the business in YC?
In YC, we were doing one company that was education technology. So we were basically building like a quiz app to help you like practice flashcards on a mobile phone competitively with, you know, a friend. And that was a good experience. Learned a lot about programming and getting apps in the app store, but really never figured out a customer acquisition loop. Couldn't really grow, and it was just very, very early. We only had 3 months to build it, and it was very rough around the edges. No employees. I was just building myself. And then the other company was doing wireless networking, kind of a precursor to the Helium network, but without the crypto side. So the idea was basically build out a bunch of wireless access points across people's houses, basically anyone that wanted to put one up, they could share their bandwidth and then anyone could connect to this kind of pirate radio network. It was very unclear what the business model would be. It was kind of just like a bunch of electrical engineers who enjoyed tinkering with, you know, wireless networking. At the time, the TV had just gone off the, like TV over the airwaves had been eliminated. So there was like open bandwidth in a different band, kind of like the 5G era when all of this was happening. So there were some questions about, you know, would there be an opportunity there? It was completely like, it was just total moonshot. It would have taken, you know, billions of dollars to probably win that. So that couldn't really raise any money. And then once that had kind of failed to raise money, we started pivoting and testing out different ideas. We built a ton of different things. Like we built a precursor to Google Stadia, where you could play video games on a server and stream it to you. We also built a tool for annotating classical music and sheet music. We built a t-shirt website. We were just building tons and tons of different stuff. We built something that was actually pretty cool and like would have worked really well if GPT-4 existed, but it was something that could help brands manage their social media accounts. So it would kind of like if let's say you're running like, you know, like a fitness company, it could take all the new fitness news on the internet and feed it to you and kind of highlight what interesting links would be able to share, interesting topics that you could talk about and kind of help you with like content production. But again, it was like super early. Natural language generation was really, really bad. You could basically just like summarize an article. You could take in a bunch of text from an article and kind of pick which sentence might be most interesting based on how relevant it was to the other keywords. Like very, very simple algorithms. But that was a lot of fun to build and kind of get out. It was like my first interaction with machine learning. We were using scikit-learn and like very, very basic Bayesian algorithms. but it was a lot of fun to develop it and like actually build it, but it never really went anywhere. We never got anyone using it. The product was not there. But, you know, probably too early, kind of unclear. A lot of those ideas were a little bit like too early. Like there's even a company that does the virtual desktop stuff now called Paperspace that's really successful, I think. And obviously the Microsoft Cloud Gaming is huge now. So there was a way, it just we weren't the right team. It wasn't the right time for us to really make it work. So,
How did you start with Soylent? Like how did you get the idea and how did you guys approach it?
Yeah, it was very simple. I mean, we were running out of money. We had, I think like, I don't know, $50,000 in the bank. We paid our rent a year in advance. We owned our laptops. We paid for internet. And we really had no expenses other than food. And we realized that in San Francisco, you're kind of caught between a couple bad trade-offs. You can eat fast food, which is unhealthy, but it's cheap and easy. You can try and grow your own food, which would be the healthiest, but super time intensive, but it is cheap. But that's not really an option when you're living in an apartment in San Francisco. Or you can try and go out and dine at like a nice restaurant, but that's really expensive, even though it's not time consuming. So Soylent was kind of designed to kind of break that. It was like, hey, let's order all these like powders online and it will be something that's like meets our base nutritional needs. It's healthy, it's cheap, and it's super convenient. Of course, you're sacrificing on like taste and experience, but that was something that we were willing to sacrifice on because we just wanted to work and program basically. So, and then as soon as Rob came up with the formulation, a CEO, the co-founder, and started talking about it online, everyone was interested and we had like 10,000 signups in a day. It was like very, very clear that this was like going mega viral and like we should focus on this 100% of the time and we should skip everything else because this was...
Why was it going viral though? Did a lot of people in SF know about it? Did you speak to people? Like, did you use any strategies for that?
Yeah, it was mostly Hacker News. Rob wrote some really, really great viral blog posts that did really well on Hacker News. And then that got the attention. It was like very weird techie guy who quit eating food, super, super viral clickbait, essentially. And so Vice News started writing about it. Discovery, we were on the cover of The New Yorker. Rob went on the Colbert Report. It was like really, really big. And basically it came down to like an age old marketing tactic. We didn't know this at the time, but Ogilvy, one of the fathers of modern marketing, had this theory that if you're trying to sell, like you need to do a stress test if you're trying to sell something new. So his idea was if you're trying to sell glue is a very boring product. It doesn't look attractive. It's not like a car, but it's not fun to look at. And everyone wants to know, is this glue strong? So really the way to do it is to show them a stress test. So he had this campaign for this French glue company where he took the spokesperson and he put glue on the bottom of the spokesperson's shoes and then glued them to the ceiling. And so it's a very high stakes scenario. If the glue doesn't work, the spokesman is going to fall and break their neck. And so you can't look away because it's this daring feat of, you know, high risk and it's very intense. And so at the time, so you can't look away. You're watching this person who might fall at any minute and they don't, proving that the glue works. And while that's happening, they're giving you the pitch on why you should buy this particular glue. And so the Soylent experiment was kind of the same thing where it was like, sure, you might not trust this weird techie to make this new food, but he lived on it for 30 days. He didn't have any problems. He says he got healthier. I'll give it a try. If this person can live on it for 30 days straight, maybe I can try it for one meal. And that proved to work.
Wow. And then how did you source? Like, where did you source from in the beginning?
You mean in terms of like manufacturing?
Yeah.
We networked and called some friends and found a manufacturer who could handle, it's called Co-Packer. And there were some problems at the beginning because we had a crowdfunding website and we'd put up our pricing and we'd raised, I think, almost $3 million for the first shipment. And so when we went to the co-packer, they knew what we wanted to charge and they would basically try and extract us for the maximum amount of money that we had. So it was a very, very tough negotiation. We had to eventually move to a different co-packer. But making direct-to-consumer products, like making these products, is not difficult. There's plenty of manufacturing. It's part of the problem of why it's hard to build a business in that space, is because it's pretty easy to actually get set up and build something with your own brand on it. It happens all the time. You see people launch all sorts of different products, and it's always just because, oh, there's a manufacturer out there that can make it, you know, for cheap and, you know, do a small run. So
yeah, but it actually, when I was in Cyprus, I was hearing about Soylent all the time. Yeah. So basically you reached audience in the other side of the world. And then also Soylent grew to be quite big as well. How were you thinking at the times? Like you raised a lot of funds as well. What got you to the finish line as well? Was it that you're thinking there is a limit to Soylent, or how were you thinking at the end?
Yeah, I mean, at the time, I mean, in the early stage, we were just thinking like, oh my God, something's working. Thank God. Like, this is like so much better than just launching product after product that just fails and gets 50 users and is terrible. We actually have something that people want to buy. That's great. Let's just keep doing that as long as possible. Then, you know, the fundraising was really about like, okay, let's take on the larger food manufacturers. Let's go after, you know, Nestle. Let's try and build a really, really big business here. Obviously, that's very, very hard to do in direct to consumer. And it didn't really pan out the way we wanted it to. It was very hard to come up with like second acts. And part of that's just because, you know, food products are very driven by cultural factors and trends and fads. And so, you know, people come in, they try a diet for a while, and then they move on to the next thing, and the trends move on. And what was popular at the time, you know, like keto and paleo and veganism, like that might not be popular in a few years. And then there's new companies that come in and focus on a different thing. This is the same thing happened with the artificial meats, all those like plant-based burger companies, plant-based stuff. A lot of those companies, they're now like facing backlash because of their ingredients, and people aren't into them as much as they were anymore. So these are all very driven by like these big, like, you know, hype cycles where they become memes and everyone consumes them. And then after a while, people kind of move on to the next thing. So it's very tricky to become like an enduring brand. It's a very delicate balance.
Yeah, being into the space, I've seen it's always a cycle. It goes from when I was younger, it was like high protein, low carbohydrates, then it became ketogenic, then it became fasting, then it became something else. It's like it's changing every year. So if you are a brand, it seems very difficult to build something there. That's very interesting. And then what did you do afterwards? Like how did you came up with the idea of Lucy?
Yeah, so it had been a few years at Soylent, and we wanted to do something different, and we wanted to focus on something that had maybe more of a moat. And we noticed that Nicorette had been on the market for 40, 50 years to help people quit smoking. It's a nicotine gum, and modern consumers weren't really using it. And so we thought there'd be a better way. So we built this company, Lucy, that was designed to be a, you know, better nicotine gum, essentially. So it's regulated differently. It's packaged differently. It's sold directly to the consumer. But also it's in a FDA lane that requires a lot of upfront investment in regulatory. And that creates a little bit of a moat. It's very, very hard to start one of these companies. We couldn't have done it unless we had the first company under our belt. But once we did, we were able to work through all of the applications, work with the FDA, and work towards approval, which was a lot of work, but, you know, obviously pays dividends.
What was different in your approach when you started, Lucy, in terms of after learning so many things in business? Like, what did you do differently?
Yeah, I think we kind of shied away from the going broad and viral marketing because like Juul had already kind of gone viral in the tobacco nicotine space, and they just wound up attracting a bunch of kids, which was very detrimental to their business in the long term. It was very good for a while, and then it wound up being very bad. And we didn't want to get kids to use this. We really wanted to focus on that older millennial consumer who maybe had already smoked or vaped and then was looking to, you know, move to something different. And so we were much more targeted on like Facebook, Instagram, and podcasts, really trying to get it just into the right people's hands, which is very, very tricky. It's very hard to have a product that you want to grow, but you don't want to grow at all costs, because that'll have backlash and it'll have a bad outcome. You don't want your product to just become a total meme that everyone's using, because then kids will use it, obviously. So it was a very delicate balance. And then other than that, I mean, we were definitely sharper on the manufacturing side, made less mistakes in a lot of different ways, just like much, much higher focus on, you know, quality and keeping things in stock and just doing best practices from day one.
Mm. And in terms of the team that you built, what learnings do you have over time? Like, what traits are you looking in people when they're joining? And what can other entrepreneurs learn from you here?
Yeah. I mean, we kept a lot of the same team. I think four of the core people at Soylent came over to Lucy. And then that was kind of like our first four people, basically. And then as we grew, you know, we were definitely hiring for, you know, flexibility, because we knew that there was going to be a kind of a pivot point where we'd move from direct to consumer to retail. So having the ability to you know, actually change how the business works over time and be flexible in that regard was important. We're also just focused on people who are really, really good at leveraging existing tools. Like e-commerce has come really far. You don't need to build all that much. So just focusing on, you know, finding someone who's a generalist software developer who can use Shopify and use the existing tools to kind of get the most value out of these things instead of rebuilding everything from scratch. Really, so there was a whole trend in like 2012, 2013, where a lot of these direct-to-consumer companies would build, you know, huge systems all by themselves, like Dollar Shave Club and Birchbox. All these companies had built like kind of their own e-commerce stacks, and they were just really, really difficult and basically unnecessary, especially now that Shopify is so good. It's really, really unnecessary. So we really tried to lean into, you know, the existing platforms and keep the company lean. And even today, I think we're, you know, under 10 people. It's pretty small.
And then you recently joined Founders Fund as well.
Yeah.
How did this come about? Did you reach out to the folks at Founders Fund? Did they reach out to you? How did this start?
Yeah, I'd done a podcast with them, and I'd spoken at one of their conferences, and was just kind of generally friendly with a bunch of people at the firm. We'd pitched Peter in the past, and we pitched the team there in the past, and kind of knew some folks over there. Never got aligned on an investment, but was always kind of a friend of the fund. And then they were looking to kind of do some interesting new things with video, and I had built up this YouTube channel, and so it seemed like a fit. So they reached out to kind of you know, chat about, you know, what doing something on video would look like, and coming on as an entrepreneur in residence seemed like a good fit, where I could kind of come in, build a YouTube channel, focus on, you know, covering their companies, but just generally be, you know, an asset to the brand team broadly. And yeah, it's been really fun. It's only been a couple months, but been very focused on the work that they've done in defense specifically, because even though I don't know all that much about it, it's really fun to learn about it. And they've been investing in defense technology for decades now. Like Palantir was a huge, huge success that no one really talks about in the venture space, but, you know, Founders Fund they incubated that company essentially, and it's, you know, a publicly traded multi-billion-dollar company. And then SpaceX obviously was, you know, people don't think about it as a defense company, and it's not, but they sell to the government a lot, and they put a lot of satellites in space. And Founders Fund was basically the first institutional money into the company, and then they're doing it again with Anduril, where, you know, it was incubated by Trey Stevens at Founders Fund, and the company's grown a ton, and now they're doing a ton of work with the government. And so There's this interesting arc where Founders Fund is been for decades, like really one of the best defense, government, technology partners. But it's completely under discussed. Like, no one really puts two and two together. And so I thought it'd be a really interesting opportunity to kind of tell that story on YouTube and try and highlight some of the stuff that they've done, because it's really impressive. And I think it's really important work. Still haven't figured out exactly how to tell that story fully. It's definitely like a big branding project, but it's been fun making videos about Anduril and kind of getting to know the team there and understand how they think through things. It's a really fascinating company.
Mm. In the first, you mentioned that you pitched Peter Thiel in the past. In the pitch that you've done, what do you remember? How did he approach it? And what do you remember from that?
Yeah, I mean, it was a great, great conversation. He's just very, very good at understanding business. I mean, people get caught up in all the different, like, you know, philosophy and politics and all sorts of stuff. But at the end of the day, he's just a brilliant business mind. And he very, very quickly understood our business and what we should do. And he gave us some very good advice. And then we didn't take it. And, you know, because we listened to other VCs and it was the wrong thing to do. So I was always left with this, you know, thing in the back of my mind, like, oh, wow, like we should have listened to Peter. And so he's always been someone that I've looked to as just a really thoughtful individual in the business community and someone who really, really understands entrepreneurship and building big businesses. And so I think the biggest thing is, like, you know, a lot of Peter's thesis is around defensibility and moat building. And there's a few ways to do that, you know, intellectual property, brand building. Those are very difficult from the venture capital mindset. More often you see network effects or economies of scale. And so, you know, just being really realistic with, like, does your company have that, or are you building towards that? And that's kind of the story of, you know, like SpaceX. Like, SpaceX doesn't have a network effect, or they don't really have a brand. Like, if you need to put a satellite in space, you're not going to pay more for a SpaceX rocket just because it's cool. It's not like a Bugatti or a Ferrari or something. You know, you're going to do it because it's cheap and they've figured out how to do it most efficiently. And they've just created, you know, incredible economies of scale. So being really realistic with yourself and your company about, okay, am I building towards something like that? That informs the financing strategy, in my opinion. Like, you shouldn't raise a ton of money and go super big unless you actually have a thesis around how you'll capture a disproportionate amount of value in the market.
Mm. But also, you raise from some of the best investors in the world in the past. If Peter Thiel told you something nobody else told you, I'm wondering, where does this come from? Like, is this from his experience? Is this from what is, like, from your interactions with him? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's an incredible entrepreneur. PayPal, Palantir, bunch of other companies. He's also built big organizations. Like, Founders Fund is, at the end of the day, a company that he built, and it's wildly successful, even though it's a venture fund. And then I just think he's very, very diligent about thinking independently, and he just really, really avoids herd mentalities. And a lot of that goes back to his time at Stanford and working with René Girard, the philosopher who talks about mimesis and mimetic desire, and how humans tend to, like, think in these patterns and in groups. And so he's very good at just putting all of that noise aside and just making up his own conclusions. And then, yeah, he's just seen everything in business. He's seen so many companies. He's probably invested in, I don't know, 1,000 companies or something. So he's seen everything. But yeah, he's just really, really, really experienced and really diligent about maintaining independence in terms of how he thinks through things.
I was actually looking for videos of René Girard, and I don't think you can find many online. Maybe this could be another.
Oh, René Girard.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's done a couple interviews, but he was kind of in the pre-video era. There's a good class on Girardian thought by, I think, a guy named David Perel and Jonathan Bi, I think. They did a whole course on it. I haven't looked at it yet, but I'm.
What videos do you think you're going to do now from now onwards for Founders Fund?
Yeah, I mean, I'm working on a big video about Anduril where I interviewed a whole bunch of the team members. That's really been fun and interesting to work on. But I want to move maybe a little bit quicker and cover, you know, a broader swath of companies. I've been focused on basically Anduril and defense technology for a few months, and I think it might be more fun to have a little bit faster pace, because Founders Fund has done a bunch of interesting investments in all sorts of companies. And I just really enjoy telling the story of a company from start to finish, even if it's some obscure company that no one's heard of. That's just kind of where I find the most interesting. And so I think I'd like to, you know, pick up the pace and talk more about a broader set of topics, broader set of companies. Founders Fund is obviously a great defense tech investor, but they've also done a ton in financial technology, PayPal, and then Stripe, and then Ramp. So they've, you know, had this like series of really, really big wins in fintech. They're also, I think they were like early investors in Mint or something. Like there's Credit Karma. There are a bunch of these companies that have been in the portfolio, and it's a little bit less exciting to talk about just because like rockets are cool and you know, AI defense is cool. But it is very interesting that they really know what they're doing in terms of fintech, and that's a lot of the DNA of the firm. So I think that'd be interesting to talk about. And then obviously there's a big energy thesis going on in Silicon Valley right now. This has been going on for a very long time, but people are starting to look at energy more seriously. So WorkRise is a oil and gas company, and then there's a bunch of nuclear companies that are doing interesting things right now. Some Founders Fund's working with, some aren't, but in general, there's just a very, very interesting turning point with nuclear right now that I think would be interesting to focus on.
Yeah. What's your process when you go after these companies? Like you choose a portfolio company, let's say, and then what do you do? Like what do people find interesting, and what's your approach? Like, do you go and meet the founders and you learn the story, or how do you do it?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I'll interview the founder. That actually tends to slow down the process. I actually prefer to just go and look at their other podcast interviews and build the video from scratch. But it is valuable, especially if the founder hasn't been on a lot of podcasts, to sit down with them and interview them. And it just adds a different layer of, you know, kind of intrigue to say, okay, this, you know, we actually went and got primary source material. It's very, very interesting when that can happen. It does take more time because you have to book it and do it, record it, and then review the script and see where the good parts are and all this stuff. It's not super, it definitely adds a step to the production. But yeah, I mean, I still enjoy just going and researching a company and just reading the existing coverage and putting that together. And that's also like the nicest thing to do for the founder's time. You know, you don't have to waste any of their time talking. You're just like, hey, we just made this video. So yeah, that's one option. But yeah, I mean, with Anderol, I went and interviewed.
I watch this. I watch a lot of videos in general when it comes to, for example, when you go into the Tesla manufacturing plant and you go inside and you speak to people there and people see inside of it what's going on. That would be very interesting. Like if you do that in Palantir, for example, and we see what's inside of Palantir, or if you do in Anduril and we see what's inside of Anduril, it's super, super interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think that is interesting. You always got to keep in mind, like, how are you framing this for, you know, a broad audience? Like, but there's definitely a way to do it that, you know, finds a balance. Like it's good for the people who know the story, but it's also good for people who never heard of this and need to be, educated about it. The hard part is that if you use very direct framing, you know, like the story of Palantir, that is only really going to appeal to people who already know what Palantir is and are interested in it. Whereas it might be most valuable to explain what Palantir is to people who don't know what Palantir is, right? So then you have to find a different way to tell that story. So finding like narrative violations or things that are counterintuitive is often very valuable. Like when I did a video about Cover, this company building homes, they're building like prefab backyard homes and in a factory. And prefab has been on the decline for the last like 50, 60 years. But all these VCs were investing in prefab home building. So why? Like, what do they know that the rest of us don't? And that's an interesting question to explore. And so whenever you can find one of those interesting, you know, questions, like, you know, oil and gas is clearly not the future. The future is solar and nuclear and all these new technologies. But, and yet, like, this company, WorkRise, works in oil and gas and is very successful. Like, why is that? Well, there's a bunch of reasons. Like, oil and gas is going away, but it's not going away today. There's a whole there's a whole industry that's going to continue for a very, very long time, even as the global economy, you know, decarbonizes. And so it's just a very interesting like narrative violation. And that is usually something that piques people's interest and gets them interested in listening to the whole story.
John, as a last question, what should we expect from the future from you? Are you going to start another business? Are you going to become a full-time investor? Or what are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, part of joining Founders Fund was like, it's an opportunity to figure that out and see what I want to do. I think I want to continue making great content, improve the production process, put out more content more regularly that always hits my quality bar. I'm doing longer videos now and they've kind of slowed down, but I want to get back on a weekly cadence, but with the longer, bigger videos. And there's a lot of other low-hanging fruit in content, whether it's like longer form stuff or shorter form stuff. There's a lot of different directions that you can take that. And then, yeah, it'd be interesting to start another business. I'm an entrepreneur at heart and I love building stuff. I just kind of want to, you know, make sure that I pick something that's, you know, a really great market and something that is a great fit for my skill set and my audience and everything that I've done all like, you know, comes together to really accelerate that. And then I do angel investing and I like that. But I'm not really sure where that goes. I'm still kind of figuring that out.
What do you usually invest in?
I mean, it's been a variety of things. You know, a few years ago, it was software, enterprise software, AI tools. I was really excited about just content AI stuff. So I invested in a few companies that did that that applied AI to very like niche content plays. I've invested in some, it's basically just like whatever's in my network and like whoever, like if I meet an interesting founder and I like what they're doing, and a lot of founders are doing like software. So that's like what comes up most of the time. But it's usually just like super early stage bets on just founders that I like. I don't have a fund and I'm not doing like Series A's or anything. So it's basically just like, oh, a friend is starting a company. Like, you know, why not support them?
Fantastic. John, thanks for the chat.
Yeah, this is great.